Morning, Chief.
Thank you. We're delighted to welcome you all to the courtroom this morning, and especially delighted to welcome three high schools who are scheduled to be here. We have students from Albany High School. Would they please stand? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. We have students from Berlin High School. Could they stand, please? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. And we have students from Mauston High School. Would they stand? Yes. It's good seeing you, too. You may be seated. The high school students are here with the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and this court. High school students across the state are invited to come to the court, and if the invitation is accepted, we supply the schools with the briefs of the case that the students are about to hear. They may do extra work about this case. They then come for an oral argument, and as part of the program, they are invited to meet with a justice of the court to discuss the procedures of the court in taking and deciding cases. We usually do that after the second case at about noon. Everyone is invited to attend that session, not only the students, anyone who would like to attend. The discussion will be the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case we are about to hear. The other thing I should ask is if anyone is not familiar with this case and would like a summary of the case, the marshal has summaries that have been prepared. It's more interesting to listen to a case if you know something about it. Would anyone like, raise your hand if you'd like a summary. Okay, if you're all prepared, we'll ask you questions as well as the lawyers. Let me, before we call the case, introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and on my right is Justice John Wilcox. And Justice Wilcox is going to be the justice with whom you all may meet at noon. And to Justice Wilcox's right is Justice Pat Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. And if I start on my far left, it's Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. And to my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case, which is 04AP2468, Wisconsin Department of Revenue versus River City Refuse Removal, Inc. Representing the Department of Revenue is Tom Creeran, Assistant Attorney General. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Thomas Creeran, and I represent the petitioner, Wisconsin Department of Revenue. This case involves an assessment by the Department against River City Refuse Corporation for River City's 1993 through 1997 tax years for failure to pay use tax upon five categories of items. First category, items purchased from out of state. Category 2, certain motor fuel purchases. Category 3, purchases of certain kinds of items used in waste reduction and recycling. Category 4, non-fixed assets acquired by River City from other corporate subsidiaries of Browning Ferris International. River City was a wholly owned subsidiary of Browning Ferris. And the fifth category, fixed assets in the form of motor vehicles that were also acquired by River City from other corporate subsidiaries of Browning Ferris.
Can I have a question. Are we dealing with 1 through 3 or primarily 4 and 5 or all of them?
We are now dealing only with five.
That's what I thought.
And the negligence penalty, which is on all five.
All right. Yes, I understand that.
Which is why I mention all five.
Okay,
because the negligence penalty is assessed on the total tax on all five categories. As you indicated, after the assessment was issued, River City either did not contest or eventually dropped its appeal on all items before the commission issued its decision, dropped its appeal on all items other than the use tax on motor vehicles acquired from other corporate cities, corporate subsidiaries, and the negligence penalty. The commission reversed the department's assessment, and it also reversed the department's negligence penalty. The circuit court reversed the commission, reinstated the assessment and the negligence penalty, and the Court of Appeals then reversed the circuit court. This court then granted our petition for review. The state receives millions of dollars annually in sales taxes imposed on intercorporate acquisitions. Millions more are received from motor vehicle sales by persons who are not engaged in business and are not attempting to make a profit of any kind. There is nothing unusual about the tax assessed by the department on these vehicle acquisitions. Until Section 7754, paragraph 49 of the statutes was enacted in 2005, Act 25, the department assessed sales tax on all intercorporate acquisitions of taxable, tangible personal property between wholly owned subsidiaries. That newly enacted subsection did exempt certain transfers of tangible personal property between members of a combined group.
I have a question on the initial taxation. If you buy a piece of a fixed asset, or you buy, let's say, a truck, you pay a sales tax on it, correct?
Yes.
Now, and maybe this is naive, but this is a transfer between solely owned subsidiaries of Brown Ferris. So when they bought that vehicle, they paid, I assume, they paid a tax on it. Now it's being transferred to a solely owned subsidiary. Is there any consideration there? And I know that supposedly there may or may not be a, quote, use tax imposed. But there, use tax, sales tax, okay? Have they already paid one tax on a vehicle that could be transferred?
Well, they may have. It would depend upon the circumstances under which the vehicle was acquired. And, you know, since we're talking about
Well, it wouldn't make any difference.
If the vehicle could have been acquired in another state where the vehicle wasn't taxable, I mean, that information, vehicle by vehicle, whether the tax was paid is not in the record.
It would not even be important. We're only interested in the transfer from Brown Ferris to the subsidiary.
Right, and the reason it's not important is because the sales tax is a transaction tax. So if I sell something to the Chief Justice and she sells it to you and you sell it to each other justice, we tax that transaction
You tax and tax, and I bought used cars, and I understand that there, you know, you can tax the same vehicle if you have 10 transfers 10 times.
Correct.
It's a great business.
Well, that's why the state's in it. Okay, now, was there any consideration between the entities?
Yes.
Follow up on Justice Wilcox's question. How much did they pay?
They paid the net book value because that was the...
Did they pay it in cash?
No, they're accrual basis taxpayers, so the way the accrual basis taxpayer simply enters in a liability. It's as if you go into the store and hand somebody a credit card. You've created a liability. There's no cash payment required in order to create that liability. So what they did here is they entered the net book value of each vehicle in the intercompany payables account. The intercompany payables account is a liability account. So when you enter an amount in that account, you create a liability in that amount. And that's what the department has to look at when it examines the taxpayer's books.
Does the taxpayer, here the person who received the vehicle, ever pay off that liability? Was there any evidence of that?
Well, I mean, there is evidence that the balances in these accounts changed, and I think we indicate at one point that in 1 year they changed like by an amount of $1.4 million, and there's a notation in that 1 year that the change was based on such items as cash received. But as a practical matter, since these are wholly owned subsidiaries, they don't ever have to exchange cash between each other. They can simply let those liabilities remain on their books because they are wholly owned subsidiaries. Their parent corporation doesn't really care if cash ever changes hands.
Counselor, that brings me to another question. What if instead of Browning Ferris incorporating all these little wholly owned subsidiaries, they just operated them as divisions and they were part of Browning Ferris, but they were separate divisions that had separate books? We wouldn't be here, right?
That's correct. Wisconsin is a separate entity state. Unlike the federal government, Wisconsin taxes every corporation, even if it's a wholly owned subsidiary, as a separate legal entity. The federal government does not do that. The federal government, typically, if you have a wholly owned subsidiary, it taxes the whole combined group as one single unit. So the federal government ignores the transactions that occur between corporate subsidiaries. We look only at the transactions that are made by the corporate subsidiary that is being taxed.
So you treat these wholly owned subsidiaries as though they were all strangers to one another?
They're treated no differently than if
I own one and you owned another, right?
They would not be treated any differently because in legal contemplation, they're separate legal entities.
I see. Thank you.
Isn't that ignoring the reality of the situation? You're dealing with wholly owned subsidiaries of the parent company?
The reality is that they are separate legal entities, and if they are going to be separate legal entities, again, this is a transaction tax. So every time a transfer is made between separate legal entities, a sales or use tax is imposed on that transfer.
So you get consideration only in terms of the argument on the accrual method. Isn't that right? Because you can't show that there was any cash or anything else that was transferred.
Well, I mean, we have the one notation for cash received. It indicates cash received in 1 year. But in general, no, we can't show for the tax years involved that any cash was actually transferred. And again, since these are wholly owned subsidiaries, it's not necessary that any cash would ever be transferred.
Well, in addition to the issue of consideration, don't you have also the issue of whether or not there's any mercantile intent here?
Absolutely.
Okay. What's your position on that?
Our position on mercantile intent is that in order for these to be taxable sales, the corporations that transferred the vehicles have to be retailers under some section of 7751.13. Now, there are three different ways under which a corporation or anyone else can be defined as a retailer under that subsection. And under those definitions, the subsidiary of a for-profit publicly traded corporation, I don't think can be in a better position under any of those definitions to avoid payment of use tax on motor vehicles than you would be if you purchased a motor vehicle from your neighbor. Now, I'll be happy to go through each of those definitions individually. The definition that I think most...
Well, let me just think about that. I know we're talking accrual, but there are exemptions so that if I, maybe I'm wrong and I want you to correct me, if I buy a motor vehicle from my mother or my mother buys one from me, that's exempt. Is that correct?
We have specific exemptions. Yes.
So this goes along with Justice Crooks's question. These are related entities, related in the sense if I buy stock in Brown Ferris, and I have none, but if I did...
Full disclosure.
That's good to know.
isn't it the relationship that we're interested in? But you're saying that because they're operating subsidiaries, but my question would be, is that part of the, so when I buy stock in Brown Ferris, am I interested in a company like River City Refuse, or is that something that their liabilities, if they make money, does that go into the general corporation or not?
Well, you've asked probably two or three different questions here. Maybe I should start out with the question involving the
model. Oh, I was just talking about exemptions in the relationship.
Sure. In your example about purchasing a car from your mother, we have a specific exemption in the sales tax statutes that for certain relatives that says if that relative purchases a car, there's no tax. And you have to be a relative as defined. I mean, your third cousin won't work. Okay. But we have no comparable exemption for wholly owned subsidiaries of corporations. So that's why this transaction is taxed, because no exemption like that applies here.
What about if Justice Wilcox, with whom I have no relation other than on the court, sells a car to me? We pay taxes?
Yes.
I'm not going to sell a car.
I picked the wrong car. Does he have a mercantile interest?
Justice Callow might. But.
Right. Does he fall under having a mercantile interest intent?
Well, I think the only, you know, you have the three different definitions of retailer under Section 775113. And the only one of those three that this Court has ever held the mercantile intent concept to be applicable to is subsection A. But I think that the subsection that is specifically applicable here, or the most specific subsection that's applicable here, is subsection AM, which really was enacted specifically to tax, to be sure that people who transferred motor vehicles or entities that transfer motor vehicles do in fact qualify as retailers. And there has never been a case, frankly, there have been few cases under that subsection, but there's never been a case under that subsection that says that mercantile intent applies to the transfer of motor vehicles. And in your example, if you purchased a vehicle from Justice Wilcox, you know, he quite likely might have a car that he just wants to dispose of. And he might just not want to pay the insurance on the car. He doesn't care if he sells it for less than book value. He just doesn't want to have the car anymore. Maybe he likes you and he wants to give you a special price on the car. But under subsection AM, we tax all of those transactions. Like, again, a typical example, if you buy a car from your neighbor, we tax that transaction regardless of any mercantile intent. And River City, as a wholly owned subsidiary, should not be in any better position than your neighbor would be to avoid a use tax on those kind of transactions.
Could I ask, do you interpret the use tax statute on transfers the same way you would interpret the real estate transfer fee statute?
Not I don't, the real estate transfer fee statute, and I have to be real honest and say I don't have a lot of familiarity with it, so I'm not sure I can answer your question, but it has all kinds of specific provisions indicating which types of transfers are taxable, not only between relatives, but also between related corporations, LLCs, LLPs, very specific as to which transfers are taxed and which are not taxed. I'm not sure that I'm in a position to make any other comparison, you know, between the use tax here and the real estate transfer tax.
Let me ask you, you referenced a change in the law during this legislative session. Could you repeat that, and what's the significance of that?
Well, I think, excuse me, I think if it has significance, it's this. Those are transfers of certain kinds of tangible personal property between wholly owned subsidiaries that are members of a combined group. A combined group would be one that files as a single unit federally. And those transfers in this particular case have to be incidental to the sale of certain kinds of taxable services. They have to be accompany certain kinds of taxable services. But the relevance of the amendment is if those kinds of transfers were already not taxable simply because corporate subsidiaries were involved, then there would have been no need to enact Section 77-5449.
Well, does the new sex law, would it apply to this case?
No. I mean, it applies, I believe. I believe the effective date is September 1st of 2000.
Suppose it was in effect at the time of this case arose. Would it apply?
No, it still wouldn't apply to
You're using it to say that the legislature obviously assumed, or whoever drafted this and got it through, assumed that transactions between subsidiaries were taxable, and this is an exception.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not saying that that the enactment of that section is something that conclusively resolves this case.
No, it's just...
Isn't that part of the biennial budget?
Yes.
Who offered that provision?
I do not know.
Well, it's Section 1503. Doesn't that sound like it's part of the original budget bill?
Yeah, I mean, it is part of the budget bill, but I don't know who drafted that provision or whether it was a departmental-sponsored provision.
Could I ask you, you cite a case from Ohio.
Yes.
Was that cited to the Tax Appeals Commission?
No.
I'm kind of interested. Does the Department of Justice take the side of the Tax Appeals Commission in any situation except when the department wins?
As you as a former commissioner are well aware that the Tax Appeals Commission is disqualified by statute from participating in circuit court proceedings and proceedings beyond. So the cases that go to court are always between the department and the taxpayer. Have there been cases where we have advised the Department of Revenue not to challenge rulings made by the Tax Appeals Commission? Certainly. But there is really no taking the side of the Tax Appeals Commission in a circuit court case because the Tax Appeals Commission is precluded from being represented at all.
But when the Tax Appeals Commission and the Department of Revenue are basically on the same side, then the Department of Justice is arguing how sound the Tax Appeals Commission's decision is.
That's correct.
But when the Department of Justice or just Department of Revenue disagrees, then suddenly the Tax Appeals Commission really doesn't know what it's talking about. And it seems to me a little troublesome that in subsequent litigation, the Department of Justice is citing a lot of sources from out of state that were never cited to the Tax Appeals Commission. And in fact, using non-Wisconsin law to try to influence the decision.
The Lindley case from Ohio deals with this exact kind of intercompany payables account. The department was arguing all along that the entry of an amount in an intercompany payables account creates a liability because it is, in fact, a liability account. It's unfortunate that the attorney who appeared before the commission apparently was unaware of the Ohio case, but the argument that is being made here before you now on the meaning of those entries is no different than the departmental attorney was making before the Tax Appeals Commission.
Counsel, in regard to the Kolash case, it's my understanding that you're asking that we overrule that case or severely limit that case. Is that correct?
What we're asking is that you hold that Frisch, insofar as Frisch discerned a profit motive requirement in order for a transaction to be taxable, that Frisch be overruled because Frisch misconstrues Kolash in that respect. I do not agree with the position of the amicus that indicates that Frisch hold or that Kolash holds that there is a profit motive requirement in order for a transaction to be taxable. If you look at the circuit court's decision in this case, Judge Nickel explains really in painstaking and very convincing detail why that cannot possibly be the case and why such a system would be unworkable. Now, we pointed out, you know, to the Court of Appeals at oral argument that we didn't think that even the Frisch case really ever intended to impose a profit motive requirement, and the Court of Appeals held in this case that, in fact, that is exactly what Frisch intended to do and that they were bound by that decision. Now, there is a brief mention in Kolash that the nuns didn't intend to make a profit, but I don't think that's the equivalent of holding that there is a profit motive requirement in order for a transaction to be subject to use tax.
But wasn't that part of the analysis in regard to mercantile intent, retailer, whether or not there was this desire for profit, an intent for profit?
It was an item that the court mentioned as indicating that the transaction should not be taxed. I mean, I think there were more important items there. The court effectively held that this was, in fact, the nun's religion to invite guests into the what one of the justices described as a monastery, and that you could come in, and if you couldn't afford to pay for the meals, you didn't have to, and that this was strictly an eleemosynary activity. And also, I believe that the tax involved over a five-year period was something like, don't hold me to this exact number, something like $1,709 over 5 years. So the tax involved was de minimis. There was an eleemosynary activity, and the items involved, there was no intent to raise revenue. But now,
isn't that the essence of the Frisch decision also, that there was no desire for a profit in regard to the photocopies?
Well, in the Frisch case, you don't, first of all, you don't have an eleemosynary activity. What the law firm did there is it charged at about cost for copies, but I mean, that clearly was a mercantile activity. I mean, if the law firm had wanted to, could have recovered the cost of the copies by charging more per hour for its legal services. What you had in Frisch was the sale, as the Court of Appeals initially held in that case, you had the sale of taxable, tangible personal property that is incidental to the sale of non-taxable legal services. And by rule, you look at that transaction, and if the transaction is incidental to the sale of a non-taxable service, you don't tax the incidental sale of tangible personal property, which in this case would be copies. Now, we don't have that in this case because the subsidiaries didn't purchase any services from each other.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Janoschek, representing River City Refuse Removal, Inc. Counsel?
May it please the Court. My name is Barbara Janoschek, and I am appearing on behalf of River City Refuse Removal, Inc. As I think some of the questions that have been raised by the Court thus far indicate, the Department, through various arguments that it makes, that effectively ask this Court to go through numerous hoops to get to the end result, hoops that require the Court effectively to disregard Wisconsin law and in its place adopt a ruling of the Ohio Court, which frankly was applying a different rule of construction to a different tax statute under a set of facts which, while it clearly includes accrual accounting entries, apparently includes nothing else, which is, makes that case quite distinct from this one, and which reaches a decision with respect to consideration being created by accounting entries without any explanation whatsoever as to the logic or rationale of that conclusion.
Let me ask you, they also want us, and there seems to be a dispute on the standard of review. We have de novo. You're arguing, as I understand it, that you want us to give, they want this to be looked at anew. You're arguing due weight, and in fact, I think in the negligence part, you're asking that we give great weight to whether there was negligence. If we didn't, and we didn't give this weight, would you lose? I mean,
no. I don't believe
you
would.
Think you, whatever standard we would use, whether it's a de novo, due weight, or great weight, you believe you would prevail?
I do.
The general rule is it's taxable unless you fall under an exception. What exception do you fall under?
We don't fall under any exception, Your Honor. We're talking about whether it's taxable in the first instance.
Why do you think it's not taxable?
It's not taxable because it doesn't fall within the requirements of the use tax statute.
Okay, what are the requirements?
To be taxable under the use tax statute, there must be tangible personal property purchased from any retailer.
Is it tangible personal property?
There is.
Okay, repurchase from?
A retailer.
Okay.
And the issues in this case focus on the purchase element and on the retailer element. Both elements must be present in order for the tax to be imposed. And I point out that we're talking here about a tax imposition statute, which means that it can be given effect only in accordance with its clear and expressed language with any doubts resolved in the taxpayer's favor.
Well, isn't there a difference, though, if you use a different accounting method in the state is arguing, look, you're using the accrual method. And if you were using, as you walk up to a merchant and you say, I want to buy that car, that's not the accrual method. Or if I understand their argument, that's why they say you never get to, it would never meet the statutory definition. I'm talking about use of the accrual method.
Right. I don't know that I interpret their argument that way, but it would be our position that accounting entries, whatever form they may take, cannot possibly create consideration. consideration either exists or doesn't exist with respect to the underlying transaction. Accounting entries merely purport to record what transpired in an underlying transaction.
Suppose there was a transfer of cash here.
Yeah, that's right.
The second corporation, the whole that's being held, transfers cash to the holding company, the parent company. Every car that comes on its books, right? What would you do then? That's what I think Justice Wilcox is asking you.
I guess maybe I don't understand that cash is paid for the cars that come on the books. Well, if there's an actual payment in exchange for the transfer, there would be consideration.
Okay, suppose I buy a car from my friendly used car lot, and I pay with my credit card so I can get miles for traveling, right? Okay. Right. And I then default. I don't pay the credit card company. And tough luck. What does the state do about the tax?
Well, there's still consideration.
Pardon me?
There would still be consideration if you used the credit card.
There'd be consideration, and I suppose that the state would go out after the seller, saying you should have. Your job was to collect this tax, and
well, I presume they either enforce it as a sales tax, or they'd enforce it on the flip side as a use tax.
Okay, so why is that any different than this accounting procedure? I mean, the state is saying they're the same, if I understood its argument, as to liability. There's a liability on the books here. They didn't, look, this company didn't have to put it on the books that way, right?
I think the real question here,
is that right?
They didn't have to put it. They had to record it. I mean, common sense would dictate that you're going to record a transaction like this someplace. The transfer of the assets is going to be recorded somehow on the books.
Right. Okay. It's a gift. But they own nothing up above.
I guess the difficulty I'm having.
Maybe gifts are taxable, too. Are gifts taxable?
I think gifts are separately taxable. I don't know that they'd be taxable as under the use tax statute or a sales tax statute. Correct. I would assume that as a gift it would be taxable under some other provision of the statute. But here we're talking, it seems to me the real question here is that we have to look at. In order for there to be use tax applied, there has to be consideration which requires, it's got to be a transfer for consideration. As I understand that, and what that seems to say to me, is that the transferring entity, the entity giving up the equipment or the vehicle, has to receive something of value. Now, that something of value doesn't have to be a cash payment. It could be a promise to pay with a concrete due date. There has to be something firm that's received in exchange. And here, according to this record, that didn't happen.
Ms. Janicek, then what was the purpose of the recording the different balances from the different books from the one company to the other? What was the purpose?
Essentially to track the fact that the transactions had occurred. And in part because Wisconsin requires that because it's a separate state concept, for federal tax purposes, consolidated record keeping is what's the norm. Here there has to be some separate record keeping, but the reality is that these accounting entries are two-part, obviously. There's two sides of the books. It's recorded as a debit to the transferor's asset account and a credit to the intercompany account. On the flip side of it, with respect to the transferee, it's recorded as a debit, with the flip side being a credit to the intercompany account. At the end of the year, it gets netted out, and there's never any payment that's actually made, ever.
I understand the netting concept. Am I correct? And I want to make sure I understand how the books are recorded. Am I correct that the way they record them is instead of showing that there's a transfer of vehicle A from company A to company B, you're actually recording a value of vehicle A from company A to company B. Is that correct?
Well, I think it reflects both the transfer of the vehicle and the book value of the vehicle at the time of the transfer.
Thank you.
Why there'd be no income, is that it? To be declared?
At the time of the transfer?
Right. If you're selling it for what your book value is or what your basis is, there'd be no income tax.
If it's transferred at book value, that's correct. There wouldn't be anybody gaining anything. There's no profit being earned on the transfer.
If this subsidiary was sold, would this account payable be an account payable that the buyer would be responsible for?
I guess that would depend upon the transaction documents.
Just assume that it's straight transaction of the stock. You're buying the stock of the company.
I don't think so. I believe that what would occur in reality is that there'd be a netting out in advance of sale and there'd be no obligation assumed there.
If I were the holding company, I'd want to keep it on the books and get paid from the new guy.
Counsel, excuse me, Justice Bronson, I just want to ask, in the depreciation that the subsidiary, so you've got this book value, is the subsidiary then depreciating it? Who's doing the depreciating?
The entity that acquired the asset is depreciating
okay.
the asset
right,
after the transfer.
All right, thank you. Justice Prosser.
Mr. Creron started his presentation describing how this case started. Went down a list, and the number five thing he mentioned was fixed assets. Number four was non-fixed assets. And the Tax Appeals Commission decision talks about the transfer of books, videos, labels, posters, brochures, fluorescent bulbs and containers, I assume among different subsidiaries of Brown Ferris or whatever it's called. Why is that taxable, the transfer?
I believe that's a reference to the non-fixed assets.
Yeah.
As I understand it, that's not part of the issues in this case. That happened to be one of the items that was part of the original audit by the department, one of the five items, the accounting for which the department took issue. Three of those items, River City ultimately conceded, and those issues fell out of the case, leaving the two items of fixed assets and waste reduction and recycling equipment, which form the basis of the commission's decision.
When the non-fixed assets were conceded, were they conceded just because we're not going to mess with this trifle, or was it because they have to concede it as a matter of law?
I wasn't involved in that part of the case, Your Honor. But my understanding is that at least some of these concessions were made because it made economic sense to make the concession. In other words, and that is in the discovery that is reflected in the record in this case.
The Browning Ferris is a national company, is it not?
It is an organization located outside of Wisconsin that has numerous subsidiaries.
There are subsidiaries in Minnesota and Illinois that are mentioned here. What's the practice in, say, in Illinois or Minnesota if the same kind of transfers are made between the parent and the subsidiaries?
I don't know, Your Honor, but I understand it to be the same practice.
Are they taxed?
What's the tax in Illinois? What is the tax statute in Illinois and Minnesota? I have no idea.
Ms. Janicek, let me ask you, because we haven't really discussed this yet, about the negligence penalty. Now, it's my understanding that the Tax Appeals Commission took the position that the negligence penalty should not be imposed on your client here. Would you explain why you think that because there was another case involving Browning pending, that gives just cause not to have the negligence penalty?
Certainly. Your Honor is referring to the BFI Wisconsin case, which was a result of a prior audit, an audit commenced earlier, and which included the very same issue with respect to waste reduction and recycling equipment that was raised by the audit of River City. And since its sister corporation was litigating and had been litigating essentially throughout this period that question with the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue never assessed a negligence penalty with respect to the sister corporation, River City adopted and took the same position until that issue was resolved, at which point River City conceded and paid the tax. And that took until the case went up to the Supreme Court and review was denied by this court.
Well, let me ask you one other question. In regard to the issue of deference, the Department of Revenue takes a position that there should be no deference given to the Tax Appeals Commission. And it's my understanding that you agree with the Court of Appeals that in one instance it was due weight deference, and the other instance it was great weight deference. Can you tell us why you feel that these are not de novo review situations?
Certainly. I think the existing precedent is clear with respect to the circumstances under which the various levels of deference are applied. And if you look at those decisions, what they tell you is that in order for an agency's statutory interpretation and application to be reviewed de novo, three factors have to be looked at. Whether the issue before the agency is clearly one of first impression, if it is, that's a factor that would suggest de novo review. If a legal question is presented and there is no evidence of any special agency expertise or experience, and the third is the agency's position on an issue has been so inconsistent that it provides no real guidance. It's our position that none of those factors comes into play in this case. And we say that notwithstanding that we're aware that the level of deference to be accorded administrative agency decisions, and in particular decisions of administrative adjudicative bodies, is a matter that's of some concern to members of this court based on the dissents in two recent decisions and on a recent law review article. That's clear. But even as I read those dissents, and there's some merit to those positions, it doesn't seem to apply to the Tax Appeals Commission in this case. When we're talking about a commission that exists for the express purpose of reviewing determinations with respect to Wisconsin state tax liability of all kinds. And that's the only thing that commission does. As a result, while certainly not everybody who's appointed to that commission comes to the commission with great experience or expertise, some members do. An example would be Tom Boykoff, who signed off on both the BFI Wisconsin decision and in the decision in this case. But beyond that, when you have an agency whose sole function is to interpret and apply Wisconsin tax law, you have a body that develops a lot of expertise and experience through the course of performing its services. And so you're dealing with an entity that, frankly, is particularly well positioned to provide what I would call the necessary fairness and consistency in the tax cases that we look to in an agency to give the taxpayer and the department. And so I think that's true just as well in the use tax situation. This agency has experience specifically with the precise issue here involved. It has other experience with applying the consideration concept in other contexts, but beyond that, consideration is a component.
You argue for great weight deference on the penalty. Why does it matter if you have great weight deference if your position is that you don't think the DOR's position is more reasonable than that maintained by your client?
Well, I guess it's the old, you don't ever put all your eggs in one basket. mean, the reality of this world is, I guess, that the precedent with respect to the level of deference to be accorded administrative agency decisions is well established, and that law supports giving the levels of deference which the Court of Appeals gave to the Tax Appeals Commission in this instance. I'm certainly not going to suggest in my briefs on behalf of my client, I'd be doing my client a disservice by not obviously making that point.
But my question was different. My question was not whether you should ignore past precedent about when you use great deference. My question was, in your brief, you argue that the Department of Revenue's position on this penalty is not more reasonable than your client's position. Well, if that's the position, you don't need great weight deference. Due weight deference causes you to win as well. So my question is, why do you need great weight deference?
Well, I guess my response again is it's the appropriate standard to apply under the case law, but beyond that, it may not be required in this instance.
Well, is it great weight deference to the Department of Revenue or to the Tax Appeals Commission?
It's to the Tax Appeals Commission. Okay. It's to the Tax Appeals Commission.
And that's only in the area of negligence. I'm talking about it's due weight and then great weight only.
Correct. Our position has been that at least due weight deference must be accorded with respect to the tax liability issue under existing Wisconsin precedent. Perhaps great weight deference is appropriate as well, but our position has been at least due weight, and that's the position that the Court of Appeals adopted and provided in reaching the conclusion that it reached. I think the other thing that I think perhaps needs to be mentioned with respect to the penalty interest aspect of this case is that kind of determination is quite fact-intensive. That's a determination, and frankly, the penalty section of that statute that imposes a substantial penalty. We're talking about a substantial hardship issue here, and it's been my understanding that our appellate courts in Wisconsin generally defer to whether it's a trial court making a criminal sentencing decision, or it's an administrative agency making a negligent assessments penalty as to whether that's appropriate or not, generally defer to the level that's providing the assessment with respect to the facts involved in the case. And so I think because of the nature of that determination, great weight deference is particularly appropriate.
But don't you have to analyze under any standard you apply the reasonableness of the position of the DOR versus the reasonableness of the position of the TAC? I mean, isn't that the comparison you have to look at, essentially?
That is correct. As I understand the rules with respect to what level of deference is provided, that due weight deference, if the determination reached by the commission is reasonable and the alternative interpretation is not more reasonable, then it's appropriate to give deference.
But we don't give any deference to the Department of Revenue.
That's my understanding. We have an adjudicative body created for that precise purpose.
Yeah, and they're a party here. They have an interest here. They're the party.
True.
The Tax Appeals Commission is supposed to be a neutral, independent body that adjudicates.
Correct.
So that's why we might give them deference.
Well, it certainly, I think, provides further justification for extending deference. But, you know, I understand that this is, from reading the recent decisions of this court, this is a somewhat messy area, apparently. And it's an area that's a little tough to get your arms around. That said, I think we're sitting in a somewhat different position here than the court was with respect to the agencies that were involved in those cases, and that we're dealing with an agency with a particular specific specialty.
Well, we also have another issue here. The agency, the agency being the Tax Appeals Commission, is interpreting cases of this court, Galash especially, but others. And we have a case that says that when you interpret a case of this court, we know it better than any agency, and we give no deference to an agency in interpreting a court decision.
I believe that's true. However, I also understand the Beecher case to make it clear that when an agency is merely applying a decision of this court as it's written, which we would contend is what happened here. The Kolash decision says what the Kolash decision says, and I take issue with Mr. Creron's contention that the Frisch decision is inconsistent with Kolash, or that there'd be some reason to overrule Frisch and perhaps leave Kolash standing. I don't think that's possible. I think the Court of Appeals was very careful, and the Frisch decision was quite careful in following the holding as well as the rationale of Kolash.
Sounds to me like you have different interpretations of these cases.
Well, we certainly, the Department of Revenue and River City certainly have differing interpretations of these cases. But I think when you look at the language in Kolash, I mean, you are left with the conclusion clearly that it is the transaction that dictates, the nature of the transaction involved that dictates whether or not it's profit-motivated or reflects mercantile intent, and not the nature of the entity involved. Kolash cites a number of cases involving nonprofit entities which were held subject to sales tax in prior decisions.
Could you address the 2005 budget amendment that was referenced earlier? What is the effect here? Let me just pointedly ask, because I'm not sure I understand. I know I don't understand this. You've got two arguments here about consideration and mercantile intent. Does the budget amendment wipe out one of those arguments for future cases?
I don't believe that the budget amendment really has any a particular relevance to this case. As I understand the budget amendment, it relates to property, the transfer of property that is an integral part of services provided by one affiliated entity for the other. And we don't have that context in this case. So I really don't see that amendment as having any impact on the outcome of this case.
If I could just ruminate with you for a minute, and this, I think, goes to something you said for a moment. If an agency like the Tax Appeals Commission applies the statutes and applies a court's interpretation, or this court's interpretation of those statutes, is it undermining its own credibility with the court in future cases?
I suppose there's a risk of that. However, that's its duty. I mean, clearly, if this court has issued a decision that interprets a tax statute, the Tax Appeals Commission can't ignore it. To the contrary, is duty-bound to apply it. And so I guess it runs the risk of a court later on saying that it didn't apply it correctly or didn't understand it. But I guess that's a risk that goes with the territory. In conclusion, I'd simply like to reiterate that we are asking this court to affirm the Commission's decision that the transfers of fixed assets from other subsidiaries were not purchases from a retailer within the meaning of the use tax imposition statute. And again, I would note both elements there have to be met. If, in fact, there's no purchase because there was no consideration, you don't even get to the second element. And beyond that, we're asking the court to affirm the Commission's factual determination that River City's actions in not reporting the fixed asset transfers and the waste reduction and recycling equipment, which per the DOR's audit report were the only reasons for imposing the penalty. That's what's specified in the audit report, and the law says that the Commission is to review the Department's reasons for assessing the penalty, that the River City's actions were due to good cause and not neglect, rendering the negligence penalty.
Ms. Janicek, is there anything in the Tax Appeals Commission decision or the decision of the Court of Appeals on the issues before this court that you disagree with? Do you think they got it wrong?
Nothing comes to mind at this point, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Creeran.
If we've learned anything from cases like Enron, it's that corporations have to keep their books in such a way that they're transparent to regulators, and that includes taxing agencies. And you can't have a system where somebody can submit an affidavit and say, well, sure, our books say this, but that isn't what they really mean. And that's exactly what's going on here. The reason that our position is more reasonable than that of River City is that you cannot enter an amount in a liability account without creating a liability.
Each of these companies file separate returns in Wisconsin?
The only one I know of is River City. I imagine Browning Ferris would file one, but the only one I'm aware of is River City.
Right.
As to the entry of these amounts in the liability account, Justice Butler touched upon it. You can put, if you want to reflect a transaction in your books, you don't have to put anything in a liability account if all you're trying to do is keep track of some vehicles. But if you're going to put something in a liability account, by gosh, you've got to put the amount of liability. If there was no liability incurred in connection with these transactions, then why didn't they put zero or a de minimis amount in the liability account?
Counselor, they really couldn't do that and then use these tax returns to file a consolidated return that would be consistent with the federal government's requirements, right?
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, they have to have separate books for us because we look at River City as a separate corporation. But it's evident that these were, in fact, costs because the non-fixed assets, which were put in the same liability account, that full amount put in there was deducted in the year that the non-fixed assets were received. The only difference on the vehicles is that they were depreciated, which means you deduct their cost over time. This whole concept of netting has nothing to do with River City's books. What they're talking about is when you look at all the combined books from the perspective of the parent corporation, you ignore all the transactions between the subsidiaries. That has nothing to do with River City's books. We're looking at River City's books to see if a liability was incurred when these transactions took place, and a liability was incurred by the amount entered in a liability account.
Counsel, I just want to get this straight, because up until now, I mean, when you bring in the Enron, which has been indicted and has been national news, and you're comparing that, are you saying that this is a there's a flim-flam, or I don't know what am I supposed to take that remark? In other words, if you're saying that this is a, is there a legal violation here?
No. I'm saying that you have to keep your books in such a way that your transactions are transparent to regulators. They kept their books in such a way that a liability was created, and regulators have to be able to look at those books and ascertain what happened. There is no recognized method of accounting by which you can put a liability in a liability, a number in a liability account, and not create a liability.
Thank you, Mr. Curran. Thank you, Ms. Janicek, for your arguments in very interesting tax case. 04AP2468, Wisconsin Department of Revenue versus River City Refuse Removal. Hearing is now concluded. The court will take a few minutes in recess so those students who wish to leave may, and other students will enter the courtroom. We are in a few minutes of recess.